Blog Talk Radio.
Don't Give Up Radio Show with Jackie Wayans. Inspiration through word and song for you.
So your world is torn apart and you're left with a broken heart and you feel that there's no real healing. Oh no, but this I know, it's more than a feeling. Jesus said it in his word, you cannot feel it, just believe it. He'll make everything, he'll make it all right. He will make it all right.
Welcome everyone to Don't Give Up Radio. I'm your host, Jackie Wayans. It is a pleasure to be with you tonight. God is always working, always moving, always doing great things, even when we can't see it, even when it seems like we're looking forward to this wonderful season we're facing, and Christmas is a few days away, and at the same time, life doesn't stop happening. So it's all about our response in the Lord and how we are able to face challenges, face difficulties, push them aside while we press through towards the dreams and the goals and the inspirations that God himself has placed into our hearts. And tonight we have a really special guest, and God orchestrated things to just make this happen, and I'm super thankful. You know, I want to set it up by just reading you a few lyrics from a song that the artist Lecrae wrote a few years back, called Like You. And he says in that those lyrics, that song, he says, showed me stuff I probably shouldn't have seen, but you barely made it out of your teens and took me under your wing. I wanted hats, I wanted clothes just like you, lean to the side when I rolled just like you, didn't care if people didn't like you. I wanted to bang like you. I wanted to bang like you. I wanted to be just like you. And of course, in that song, Lecrae is referring to those male role models that he had in his life, and the only ones that he had available to him that started to mold him and direct the path that he started to go in. But thankfully, the Lord intervened, and he's the man of God that he is today. Likewise, our guest Michael Barrett. He knows this all too well as he grew up in the Harlem, New York City streets and had many influences of men in his life, particularly his dad, that poured into him what they wanted him to drink. You know, they gave him the Kool-Aid, so to speak. And now he's learned not to allow anyone to just pour into his cup, and he's here to share his journey with you. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a blessing to be on your show this evening.
Well, I'm just glad that it happened and we were able to get you in as the last show for 2015. I think that this is going to be an awesome message to leave with. So your life has actually taken a lot of twists and turns, and the place that you are now, you know, currently you are doing a number of great things. I'm not going to give it away yet, but you didn't start there. And on this show, I always like to go back. I always like to find out who our guests were when they were growing up, what their childhood was like. So set us in, you know, you're here in Harlem, New York City. What was your childhood like? What was your you know, home life like?
I can take you back as far as when I was about 3 years old. I remember my mom and I hiding under the bed. My father was a major drug dealer in Harlem, New York, and my mom and I were hiding under the bed. My father had a beef with another crew, and they came into the house, and they were intent on killing me, his first son. And I was hiding under the bed with my mom, and I don't remember the story, but her telling me the details and everything, I visualized, you know, being under the bed with my mother and two gunmen coming into the house looking to kill me. And so that's my life in a sense of a young man growing up, not even knowledgeable enough to understand what he's being birthed into. My mother was a young working woman, and for her, she didn't want that life for me. And at a young age, she saw things that she didn't want me to be a part of. So she quickly made the decision to move out to Los Angeles in her early 20s with me as well and my younger brother.
That is a very dramatic open. I can visualize that. I can see a mother trying to protect her child under a bed, you know, whatever that takes to keep you from being found and your life being stolen at a young age. And I understand you're saying, you know, you were told this story. It's not one that you have a full recollection of, but it's definitely one that will categorize and set and paint the picture of why it was so important for your mom to remove you from an environment that she thought, you know, was dangerous for you. And clearly, you know, choosing to become a single mom of two boys is not something that women opt to do. So she chose to take you guys from the East Coast all the way to the West. And so what was that adjustment like for you? How old were you when you got out there, and what was it like in this new world, new environment?
When we moved, I was 8 years old, and I remember that very well. I'll never forget getting in the cab and heading to the airport at the age of 8 years old. And for me, 8 years old, it may sound like very young, but that was all I knew, Harlem, you know, running up and down the streets and the block parties and the water hoses, you know, spraying up the kids and everything. And, you know, it was a fun time. And here my mother was saying, you know, we're leaving. And, you know, I had all my cousins and family there, and that's all I knew. And when we decided to come to California, for me, it was a new adventure. And I was like, why do we have to leave? You know, so it was a sad moment. Although California was beautiful and everything, but at that age I was saddened because I had never left my family. And so we moved out here to California at the age of 8 years old. And my father had been captured, incarcerated for a drug offense. They arrested him one time at his club. And, you know, I heard that he was in prison. So for me, it was like, okay, my dad is in prison. We're moving 3,000 miles away. You know, what do I do now? And as much as my mom, you know, tried to comfort that it's going to be okay, you know, me, you, and your younger brother, I just had a sense of loss because of, you know, the fact that I was leaving my family as I always only knew.
Yeah, as you mentioned that, I think of the many movies that I've seen where moms, you know, kind of try to pick up and leave and move their family to a better life, especially if they have sons, to take them to a place that they think is going to offer them better opportunity than what they currently have. And from your point of view, you know, your uncles, your cousins, everyone in your family that you loved, you were leaving behind to start from scratch. So I can understand how you would have almost like a immediate homesickness, so to speak, from that. Did you adapt? How long did it take you to get into the swing of things in California?
It took a little while because moving from New York back in the early 80s, you know, the culture was different. You know, you didn't have the rap music as you have it today. So the clothes were different. You know, I would come out here with my British walkers and my ballets on, and I was in, you know, a young guy, and, you know, they would look at my dress and be like, well, what has he got on? And they had khakis and T-shirts, and I'm like, well, what they got on? And, you know, so it was a big difference. But, you know, one thing I was, like, turned off by the gang atmosphere, I never got adapted to that, even though we moved to Inglewood, California, which was, like, the heart of just gangs. I was the movie, I believe it was Boys in the Hood, you know, where it took place at. I lived in that area in Inglewood, and, you know, there was Bloods and there was Crips and there was Mexican gangs. And this was all new to me because in Harlem we didn't have that. You know, you had the street hustlers and pimps and the, you know, the prostitutes and the drug dealers and the stick-up kids, but I never saw the gang activity like I did once I moved out here to California.
That's very jolting. And, you know, again, sometimes we think we're doing something to benefit, and we just find a different type of danger. You know, there's always going to be some type of obstacle that we face. But thankfully, you're saying to me that you weren't drawn in by that. It didn't have any kind of lure or appeal for you. So clearly, you managed to maneuver your way around that, which is quite a blessing. As we were talking, you were there for about 2 years, finally adjusting, finally making friends, and getting Connect Else happened that sets things back a bit. Share that with us.
Well, while in California, I'll never forget, my friend and I, we were riding my bike down the street, down Crenshaw Boulevard, which is a well-known boulevard in Inglewood and L.A., and as we're riding down the street, a car pulled up, and my godfather was driving, and my father was in the passenger seat. And at that time, you know, I knew that my father was in prison, so in my mind, I'm like, oh, my dad is home. I didn't know that he had actually escaped from prison. So in 1981, he actually escaped from a New York prison and came out to California intent on bringing me back to New York. And that's exactly what he did against my mother's wishes. And, you know, I found myself back in New York at the age of 10 years old. And here I was in my dad's club, 10 years old. I seen the barmaid, the women that worked for him.
Wait a second. I just slow down because I want to kind of process this. You're riding your bike with your friend.
Yes.
You finally adjusted to life in Cali. A car pulls up. You're not alarmed because it's your godfather. And next time you see your dad, what starts going through your mind when he says get in? And, you know, what were you thinking to yourself?
For me, it was like, you know, wow, that's dad. You know, my godfather lived in L.A., so he would always come through to visit us. But to see my dad in the passenger seat, in my mind, it was like, how did he, you know, and then I didn't question it, because I'm like, well, maybe they just let him go. I don't know what I said at that age, but I was excited to see my father. And the next thing I know, he was like, Junior, get in. And I gave my bike to my friend, and he rode my bike home, and I'm rolling with my dad. And it was like, oh, wow, we've, like, united, you know, me and my father. And, you know, he called my mom later on that evening and said, look, I'm taking my son back to New York with me. And next thing you know, I'm on an airplane with my dad heading back to New York. And we land, and we ended up in Harlem.
So did you feel any kind of way about that, like leaving your mom being taken away? Did it seem to you like you were being taken away?
It didn't feel like it was I was being taken away, because it was my father. And I do remember we went to the mall, and he just bought me a bunch of stuff. He was like, what you want? And I'm like, I want that, I want this. You know, and these things I remember clearly. And at the time, you know, I'll never forget, he had his girlfriend with him, you know. So she was like, whatever you want, just tell me, you know. And I'm like, wow, you know, this is cool, you know, because my mother was a working woman, and it was hard for her to go places and say, whatever you want, just tell me. You know, she had to say, well, son, you can get those tennis shoes, or you can get that, but you can't have that. And I didn't understand that at that age, you know, because I was spoiled by my dad and my uncles at that time.
So to you, you were just taking a trip with your dad. You were just going back to New York City. He made it smooth and easy for you. He, you know, bought you all this stuff, and excuse me, you said you came back and you went to his club. Tell us about that.
My dad had one of the biggest clubs in Harlem at that time in the early 80s. It was a club on 145th Street and 7th Avenue, and back then it was called an after-hour joint, where, you know, they sold drugs and people would hang out and gamble and different things like that. So when I went there, you know, I saw the women, I saw the money, I saw the Cadillacs parked outside and all the cars parked outside. And, you know, when my father walked in the door and I'm walking behind him, you know, how people just greeted him, and they would pat me on the head and say, oh, look at little Mikey, you know. And it was like, wow, look at the respect my father is getting. He's the man, you know, and I'm walking right behind him. So I'm walking in his footsteps, and I'll never forget that time. And after that, he had left that day, and that was literally the last time I saw my dad on the street, because a few months later he had got arrested, and that was it.
Did you know when you walked into this club why, you know, what was going on? I mean, now you're talking about the drugs and the ladies and all that, but as a kid, what did you really see? What did it look like to you when you, I hear you saying that you actually were looking up to your dad, like, this is amazing, look at how people are respecting him. That's really what you were taking from that moment, right?
Yes, yes, yes. When I say that, I mean, you know, pretty women would come up to him and hug him, and I would see people giving him a bag, and at that time I didn't know whether it was drugs or money, but I saw the exchange, and I would go in the back office, and I saw the safe, I saw the guns on the table, you know, I saw drugs, you know, so I knew even at that age, I saw things that I shouldn't have saw, but I knew what I saw.
When did you start to get an inkling that maybe it, what your dad was doing wasn't actually good?
One thing I realized even at that age, and I have to be honest, I didn't get an inkling in his presence because it all appeared to be what life was, you know, so I didn't get that feeling. The only time I would get that is when my mother would speak into my life and say, I don't want you to end up like your father. And that was like, well, there's a distinction. His life is not what she wants, then there must be a wrong to his looking right. And that's when I would get that sense of that's wrong. But
and
I
you
never
also
got
had,
that from my father.
You actually had a little conversation with your cousins, as cousins tend to do. They kind of reveal hidden secrets of your family to you that you might not know about, and they're the ones who kind of start to call your dad jailbird and start to have you feel emotions about him that you didn't necessarily feel when you were with him. Can you share that story?
Yeah, that's when my dad got captured, it was in the newspapers. When he escaped, it was in the newspapers. And when they caught him, it was in the newspapers. And I never forget, my cousins, they had saw it, and they were saying, you know, your dad is a jailbird. He's in jail and this and that. And I was like, that's when it was like, man, you know, like, it was like, okay, that little short look at the hero is gone because now he's put away, you know, but little did I know that someone would replace him, you know, so it just really kept going. But I did feel a sense of being let down, like, wow, they took my dad away from me.
So your life has been, up until this point that we're listening to, it almost plays out in my mind like a movie. It seems so surreal, and at the same time, you're going through so many changes as a little boy, not only in family dynamic and space and time where you're living, but also in your thoughts and your mindset. Your psyche is being developed by all these things that are happening. So when we return, we're going to find out the choices that you started to make for yourself and what changes start to happen in your life.
Okay, sounds great.
Do I have any worshipers in here tonight? Can you do me a favor? Can you stand up on your feet? I know you've been sinning all night. But come on, everybody that's at a table, can you stand up on your feet in the balcony? Come on, everybody. We came to worship him tonight. So if you can you lift your voice and just make some noise? Come on, everybody.
Oh,
Don't Give Up Radio Show with Jackie Wayans.
Inspiration through word and song for you.
We're back with Michael Barrett, the author of the book Surrender. And we just started the show with a little bit of background, and his life was filled and riddled with many changes, and these weren't wonderful changes. These it seemed to be very confusing, very emotionally challenging changes. And sometimes when we're in those type of circumstances, we start to make choices that actually don't better our situation. They don't provide better outcomes, but they seem at the time, they seem as if they are the right way to go. And so here you are, Michael, you're back. You're back from, actually we didn't even talk about that. You said to us that your father was arrested again, and
yes,
you were in New York City when that happened. So you wound up back in California. Your mom at that point came and got you and took you back to California once again.
Yes.
So, you know, the changes are ever flowing and ever continuing.
Yes, they are.
So how was your mentality different when you got back to California over the years of you, you know, now going from a little kid basically into your preteen teen years? What did Michael Barrett Jr. start to look like? You know, did the streets have an allure for you? What were some of the choices you started to make?
I found myself, although I didn't get caught up in the gang activity, I did find myself getting caught up in that crowd that were known as hustlers. And hustlers back then, they would sell a little drugs on the block, be able to go to the mall and buy clothes, be able to buy little motorcycles and different things like that. And it all started, I'll never forget, a lot of my friends at school, they had these scooters, and they were like Elite Threes and all that in the 80s. And I remember asking my mother, could she buy me one? And it was very expensive back then. It might have been like $1,300. And she said, you know, she couldn't afford that. And I knew, had my dad been home or contacted one of my uncles, no problem, they would have gave it to me. So what I realized is that, you know what, my mother's 9-to-5 is taking care of our needs, no question about it, but I began to grow into my wants, and I believe that that's where I began to walk in the danger zone, because when you walk in your needs, you know, they're taken care of, but when you start to go outside of that and start looking for your wants, then you have to create ways to get the things that you want. And so I gravitated to the hustlers in school. After school, we would go on the block in the local neighborhood in Inglewood and sell drugs. And that profit would average out to maybe, let's say, $700 every few days. And for somebody like myself, I was 15 years old. I was able to buy a scooter. I was able to buy the nice chain. And I'll never forget my mom one day seeing me with the chain on, and she said, where'd you get that from? And I said, oh, that's a friend of mine. He let me use it. I don't know if she was being naive or she was just working so much she didn't really catch on, but I actually got arrested on that scooter one night, and they called her to come get me from the police station, and I was 15 years old, and I ended up in juvenile hall facility, and lo and behold.
Again, slow down a little bit, because you're giving us so much to process, so much to process with one little life, because, you know, you made an important point there about wants and needs, and I want the listener to connect with that, because we've all gone through this as teenagers. We've all had to make these choices where you want something. It's not the wanting it that's bad. It's wanting it now. I want it now. I don't want to wait. I don't want to save $25 a week to get it in a year. I want it now, right? And that's where the shortcuts come in. And you didn't look at the drug lifestyle as a shortcut. You actually looked at it as a way of life because of the experience that you had watching your dad. And so it just seemed like a natural, normal step for you to take and to do this. Did you feel any guilt or anything like that when you were dealing with your mom or you know, something inside of you saying this is not the way to go, or were you more, you know, comfortable at that time doing that?
I wasn't totally comfortable because my mother would take us to church at a very young age, so I did experience that. But what happened was, even though my father went to prison, I was able to go back to New York to visit my family every year. Every summer I would be able to go back. And so my uncles stepped into his place. So it was like they became the father figure, you know. So here I was in L.A., and I still got my father figures in New York, and I just wanted to be like them. Now I got three father figures, my dad, my uncle, which was my mother's youngest brother, and then my dad's sister's son, who was my cousin, but because he was older, he was that uncle figure, and their lifestyle was nothing more than a duplicate of my dad's lifestyle, you know. So I just tried to emulate that out here in California and got caught up with the crowd that was about hustling and making some money.
So you said you got arrested and you went to juvenile detention. And all of us adults, all of us parents and our moms, when we hear a young person gone to juvie, the first thing we think is, oh, well, this is horrible, but hopefully that'll straighten them out. Hopefully they'll be so scared straight that they'll never want to go back to that again. And, you know, it'll solve our problem with them. And when they come out, we'll get them back on the path. That's how adults tend to view that situation. What was it like for you?
Juvenile hall to me was like a boys' camp. I was sentenced to 6 months, you know, and I had to go to juvenile hall, and then I went to juvenile camp for 6 months. But, you know, in juvenile hall, you playing cards, you playing dominoes, you know, you joking. You got to go to school in there and stuff like that. But my friends didn't get caught, and they were out there making money. So the 6 months that I was gone, by the time I got out, you know, they were into purchasing cars at 17 years old. And I'm like, man, and so I didn't, although I was like, man, I don't ever want to go back to juvenile hall. By the time I got out and saw what they had done in a few months, it was like, I got to get back in the mix with them, you know, and that's exactly what I did. I got right back in the mix with them and not even thinking about, well, what about if you get caught again?
You know, I'm just, it's just so amazing. It's like the lure of the glamour and what you can get right away and the lifestyle. So forget scooters now. You're into cars. You stepped up to another level. Tell us, how did it go from one thing to the next? Because, you know, you went from being that kid doing that to being in Harlem, you know, a street soldier, which is huge, and you know, pretty much following directly into your dad's footsteps. So how did you continue to follow that line?
When I got out of juvenile hall, I got right back in the mix of selling drugs. I did finish high school. I graduated from high school. But by the time I was 17 years old, I had my first car. You know, and out here in the 80s, you know, when you putting Daytons on your car and the sound system and the girls is chasing you and this, you know, you're going shopping and different things, you just think that you're the man. And I was nothing, you know, but somebody chasing after something that was really a false reality. But I did chase that. And what I believe happened to me at a young age, a seed was planted. My mother planted a seed and my dad planted a seed and my uncles planted a seed to add on to my father's seat. And what I realized is that both voices were preaching. My mother was preaching one thing and my father and uncles were preaching. And I just listened to their voice more so than her voice, you know, not realizing, because the allure of that life, that street life, it was so enticing, you know, and I just gravitated to it more and more, and enough was never enough. So I just felt that, you know, this is what I want. You know, my mother said, why don't you, you know, when you graduate, just go to college. And I said, no, I want to go back to New York to visit. And I believe that that's when I decided to make the choice that would alter my life. That one decision.
It's all about the choice and the choices that we make within a moment. And like you said, you had many different seeds being planted in the soil of your young life, right? And so your mom's there, and she's one consistent message, as moms usually do, not, you know, for the most part. And then you have all these other outside influences, and through doing over 100 episodes with this show, sometimes it's a boyfriend, sometimes it's family members, sometimes it's friends. But for you, it was male role models. And that really shows how important it is for men to step up and be the right role models. But nevertheless, these are the role models that you had. And you had your eye on that lifestyle, and you pursued it. Tell us all that you kind of had under your belt by the time you were 23 years old.
Well, I graduated from high school and took a crew back to New York with me, a crew of my friends out here from L.A. And next thing you know, we just caught up. You know, I teamed up with one of my uncles who at the time was well-known in Harlem. You know, he was a major drug dealer in Harlem, took over my dad's club. He had a grocery store, club, women, cars, you know, everything. It looked like to me he had more than my dad had, you know, and that just blew me away. And I really just was walking in his footsteps more so as well. And my friends always wanted to know what New York was about. So they was, you know, up for going, and they came out to New York. And here we were in the midst of Harlem, 140th Street, right in the center of Harlem. And, you know, we were dealing drugs in the block, you know, and we had spots in the block 24 hours, 7 days a week, you know, and I partnered up with my uncle, and next thing you know, I'm fully in the drug game.
Big time, too. I mean, you not only did that, but you started investing, so to speak. You know, you had houses, you had properties, you know, had your cars. And eventually you got married as well. And when did you decide, or did you come to a point where you decided for yourself that you didn't want to be a part of this? Because interestingly enough, outside of the time that you were arrested for juvie, you had not had any other encounters with being arrested or any other altercations or life or death threats. And all this is well detailed in your book, Surrender, which we're going to tell the people how to get their hands on at the end of the show. So stay tuned. It's only getting better, folks. This is just the tip of the iceberg here. So my question to you is, you know, at that point of your life, because we're not trying to glamorize the lifestyle, but that's what it looked like. You know, that's what it was for you. You did not have the type of harassment that dangers pursue you that some of the people who do this on a day-to-day did, and you made some interesting choices with your expenditures, with your gains. What made you, you know, decide to get out of the game?
My father and my uncle at the time, they wasn't really getting along. My father was in prison. My uncle was out in the streets building his drug organization. And for whatever reason, they didn't get along. So I would go see my father and then come back to my uncle. And my uncle was like, man, you know, every time I turn around, you want to see your dad. So their riff almost spilled out to a family big thing. So what I did was I basically went further upstate New York. So I had left Harlem, went upstate New York to Binghamton, New York, and going up to Binghamton, New York, took a crew up there, and we just began to get into the drug game up there, which was a bigger profit than it was in New York City. So for me, I learned everything from the streets of L.A., my uncle, my dad, and then here it was now, and I said, okay, now and I'm at a point where, you know, my brother and I, we go up there, and it's like, okay, now this is territory that we're going to establish. You know, we're our own man now, and we're our own bosses now. You know, let's do it this way. And I begin to get the drugs from California and bring them back to New York, and the profit margin was just huge. And at the time, I had a girlfriend. And I had several girlfriends. I had several children by several women. But one particular young lady I met, And it was like, you know what, this is, now I feel I have everything I want. You know, I want to slow down. I want to stop. And I attempted to what I would call get out of the game. At the time, my mother convinced me, you know, why don't you open up a business or something like that. So her and I, we opened up a restaurant, a recording studio in Binghamton. I had a club. I was a partner with somebody at a club. So we had the club. We're doing skate parties and different things. So for me, it was like, okay, I found myself like the legitimate side was good, so I could take the money from the game and put it over here and do this. And then at that time, the early 90s, the hip-hop music was becoming real big in the black community. And, you know, this is when people like Puffy was throwing parties at City Hall and different places. And, you know, I had the East Coast and West Coast sound. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to get into this. And I found myself like, okay, this is the next move. But lo and behold, when I went to this town, Binghamton, and linked up with some people from Queens, the feds was on them because of some things they had did. And they put the feds on me. And lo and behold, when they got arrested, the feds was investigating them and started investigating me as well. And next thing you know, at a young age, I was arrested under a federal indictment along with 40 other individuals.
You never, never know when the seeds that you've sown will actually bloom and reap your crop. And so even yeah. though you were on your way to try to exit, you had really just put too much in the ground for you not to find yourself in this situation. And so here it is. You're arrested, and though you didn't think it would happen, you were also convict time, were you sentenced for, and talk to us about what those years in prison looked like.
I was charged at the age of 23 with a continued criminal enterprise, an 848 drug conspiracy. That's a leader, organizer of an organization. I went to trial. I didn't get arrested with no drugs or anything like that, so I'm feeling like, you know what, I'm going to trial. And six of us out of the 41 went to trial. And when I got convicted, I got 21 years and 10 months. That's 262 months. And for me, that was like, it just shattered everything, you know, like my family, everything. Because like you said, I had sown so much negativity. It was just a matter of time before it comes back to you, and they say karma, but it's a biblical scripture that says, you know, if you sow to the flesh, you shall reap from the flesh. And that's what I did. I sowed to my flesh. You know, everything that my flesh desired, I gravitated to it, I chased it, and I obtained it, and not realizing that one day I would have to come back and pay for that. And that's what my mother used to always try to tell me. Son, you will end up like your father if you keep on that path. But I believe her prayers led me to prison versus death. It could have went one way or the other.
No, it is definitely clear that someone was praying for you. And out of, you know, everything that you told me, it's clear that your mom was playing that role. And I have to say, moms who are listening, do not give up on your children. That's why
yes.
we're here.
Yes.
That's why
Amen.
We are here.
Amen.
We need to continue Amen. To pray for them and allow God to do his thing. And our time is going so quickly, and I want to make sure that they hear what God did to transition you and where you are in your life now. So just to kind of help accelerate the story a little bit, you know, your mom, like you said, she never stopped praying for you. And you know, here you are, you're doing 18 years. The first nine, you just were in there doing your thing, still trying to hustle, still trying to do the business thing, still trying to get your sons into the hip-hop business and all that. What started to happen to kind of strip you and to make you see that you actually needed to make the change in your life?
I began to realize the very things that I chased, everything began to vanish. So it was like the reality of what I was willing to give my life for was being exposed, and that's the street life. The friends betrayed me. I lost everything. And my wife at the time, because she had married me while I was in prison, you know, she did 8 years with me, but she just couldn't take no more. She went on with her life. I began to lose all my appeals. So I'm on my ninth year, and it was like God was just stripping me down to get my attention. And on that ninth year, I went to a Bible study inside of the prison and let you know that, you know, the word was coming to me, but I was just fighting against the will of God, and you can't box with God. Now, I realized that. So he beat me down to a point where I went to a Bible study, and one night, I'll never forget, I just cried out to the Lord and, you know, said I was tired. And I just said, I heard myself say, Lord, I surrender. And I surrendered my life to the Lord that night. I believe it was February 2004 in Raybrook Federal Prison. And when I gave my life to the Lord, I realized that this was a decision that I had long been awaiting, but it came in God's time.
And you know, depending on who we are and how we respond to things, quick we learn versus rebel, it all has to do with how long things take. But God was pursuing you, and you made it because of him. And what's
yes.
the beautiful thing, we'll talk more about this when we come back from this break, is the fact that, you know, people will always remember who you were, what you did, but it's God who sees the best in you. God is the
Amen.
One who knows what he put in there, and he knows what he can get out. And he doesn't do it to use you or to use you up like this world or this system that we live in does, but he does it so that you can be a blessing to so many others. So when we come back, we're going to hear exactly how that transformation and the wonderful changes that came into your life because of that.
He saw the best in me when everyone else around me could only see the worst in me. I wish I had a witness tonight that he saw the best in me. I guess I'm the only one that got this testimony. When everyone else around me could only see the worst in me. Can I tell y'all one more time? I said he saw the best in me. When everyone else around could only see the worst in me. I wish I had a witness tonight. All I need is one. Hey!
He saw the best in me.
When everyone else around me, anybody have that testimony? When Trump walked you off, said you would never make it, what did he see?
He saw the best in me.
When everyone else around me, can I tell y'all one more thing? I just need to tell you one more thing. Listen to this. See, he's mine. And I am his. It doesn't matter what I did. He only sees me for who I am. Does anybody know that tonight? Oh, see, he is mine. And I am his. Said it doesn't matter what I did. See, he only sees me.
Yeah.
Don't Give Up Radio Show with Jackie Wayans.
Inspiration through word and song for you.
As you've been listening to the show tonight with Michael Barrett and your lifestyle, your choices, and you're listening and you think to yourself, you know, I want to make a change. I see that these choices are not leading me, leading my family into the right direction. You know, for Michael, it was the street life, it was drugs. For you, it could be something else. No one might know what it is from looking at you, but you know what it is. And I give you Romans 10:9, that if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. That is a promise. It is not a suggestion. It is a promise that you can definitely hold on to. And that is your starting point. And that is the starting point where we left Michael after all these years of living a lifestyle that was just, you know, whatever you wanted to do and reaping the rewards of that and then paying the price. You did your full 18 years in prison, and that's a very long time, and our time is going so quickly. But I know one of the things that you mentioned to me that was the latter 9 years while you were in jail, it was almost like you were in Bible college, you know, that God really used that time to educate you about himself. Can you describe for us how people responded to you? How did family and loved ones start to respond to you when you shared with them that you now belong to the Lord?
Initially, it wasn't received well by those who really knew me. My mother always had my back, whether it was right or wrong. You know, she was always there. But others were skeptical, like, oh, yeah, you're in prison. Now you give your life to the Lord. You're talking about this Jesus stuff. And because the only reason is because they only knew the dark side of me. They didn't know that good side. So you can't comprehend that. And especially so many people go to prison, then they claim a religion, and then they get out, and the religion stays in the prison, and they come right back out as they were. So I didn't get that at first, but then I got it, and I said, I'm not in this to prove to them. I'm in this because God had really made a change in my life. And you talk about Romans 10:9-10, and that's what took place. And when I confessed Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior, that change came over me. It wasn't an instant change, but change came, and I felt that Spirit, you know, come into me and begin to change my life. And I began to teach Bible study in the prison. I began to start preaching to inmates and staff, whoever I could tell about Jesus, whether it was in a letter, sending out to someone on the outside, or a phone conversation, or a visit, or inmates in the prison. That was the 9 years. So the last 9 years became like Yale instead of jail. It became like seminary school, because God had used that place to be an incubator to birth a ministry within me that would eventually, upon my release, be birthed out of me. And that's where I find myself today. You know, I walk right out of the prison into the ministry. You know, there was no in-between time. I literally walked out, walked right into the church, and had a ministry position, because 2 years before my release, the warden allowed me to come out for about 8 hours to preach in a church and go back to the prison. That was unheard of. You know, so those things, God had given me favor, and it had opened up the door for God to begin to order my steps upon my release, which I was arrested in New York, but the last 5 years of my sentence, I did out here in California, which turned out to be the very place where God wanted me to start back over.
Wow. Tell us what start back over looks like, meaning today, right now. You are involved with a number of ministries. You've written the book Surrender. I know you talked about how you were doing the drugs in Binghamton, and now you've gone back upstate to do things completely different. So just hit us with the many things that God is doing in your life now, and then I want to bring Lakeisha, your wife, on for just a few minutes and talk with her.
Amen. So my now today looks far greater. It's like Job. You know, God just restoring me. Everything I thought I lost, sometime in life you have to lose what you think is everything in order to gain everything that God has for you. So my now today, I am married. My wife and I traveled back to Binghamton with my manager and with family to the very town to minister to people, to give people hope and to show them, hey, listen, if God could take somebody like me, you guys know me, if God can take me and change my life and bring me back to the very place and share his love, his grace, his mercy with you, then there is hope for you. So my wife and I speak at schools out here in California. I go into the juvenile halls. I sit under Apostle Ronald Hill at Love and Unity Church, which is a big church out in Compton, California. My wife and I work on a Christian television network 24 hours, 7 days a week. We're answering the prayer phone. We're ministering to people. We preach on the network. We do Bible study on the network. And it's on the local cable channel out here in California. You know, and I've written the book. And also John Singleton's daughter, Justice Singleton, rewrote the script to the book. So we are in the works of talking with several people about financing this film. So there's a lot that God is doing. And again, it's not for me. It's for the glory of God.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I said it earlier as you were speaking. I could just see it playing out in front of my eyes, and I think it would be such a blessing because it's real. It's not going to be something that someone made up in their head. This is real, and they can't say this is not what the power of God was able to do in your life. And and Lighthouse TV, that's what you're on. You also have Talking with the Barretts on YouTube, correct?
Yes, we do.
And your own website, which is kingdomtainment.com. That's kingdomtainment without the E, one word, kingdomtainment.com. And where can people access you for the book?
They can actually go on kingdomtainment, KINGDOMTAINMENT, kingdomtainment. Instead of entertaining people, we're giving people things of the kingdom. And they can go on there, they can order the book, they can see some other things that my wife and I are doing. And God is just moving, you know. It's not about the material things, you know. I don't get caught up in the fancy cars and the this and the that. I'm just a soldier for the Lord now because I realized there was a time in my life I was a soldier for the devil. So I'm a soldier for God now, and whatever he calls to do, I always tell my wife, if it's gas and I call, we're going to go and do it, you know, because God has been so good to the both of us and given me a second chance.
Yeah, I met both you and your wife when you were here in Harlem, and I saw that in you firsthand. You were not there for signing and selling books. You were there to really reach those who came and let them see the power of God and what he was able to do in your life. In fact, is your wife nearby? I'd love to talk with her for a second.
Yes, she's right here. Yes.
Hello. Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Very well. You know, our time just zipped by, and so what I'd like to do, because your role and your part in the story is so amazing and so crucial, can I have both of you back in February? February is going to be my couples month, and I'd love to do a show on both of you, find out how you knew for sure that Michael was the one for you, and how you were able to live your lives together and to just continue to do the wonderful things you do. Will you be able to do that?
Of course, yes. That would be a blessing and an honor. So we're looking forward to hearing from you in February.
Awesome. No, will you hear from me before then, and everyone else will hear from you in February. You guys have been a real blessing tonight. Thank you so much for sharing your story and being transparent.
Thank you for having us. God bless you. Merry Christmas.
Thank you so much. And God bless
you. Thank you. Thank you. Same to you and your family and to the listeners. Merry Christmas to you and a Happy New Year. We will be back for the new year in January. We'll be focused on singles. I'm coming out with a book on being single and celibate from the point of view of someone who has been married before. And in February, I'm going to shift over into couples. And so we're definitely going to have you back. We're going to get our bodies and our minds and our spirits right for the Lord in this new season. And a new season doesn't necessarily have to be the four seasons of the year or a holiday season, but the season that God has you in. And right now, if you've been listening to the show, I want to encourage you to continue to be your own best hero, because the greatest hero of all said that you are worth it when he gave his life for you on the cross. Until then, make good choices, because every choice is a seed in the ground. And when you know you have good seed working for you, it will all be good and work out for good in the end.
for grace.
For what else?
For favor. This is my season to reap what I have sown. Everything is working together for my good.
Say this tonight, real simple, say.